This is Audible.
Guards, Guards by Terry Pratchett, read by Tony Robinson. This is where the dragons went. They lie, not dead, not asleep, not waiting, because waiting implies expectation. Possibly the word we're looking for here is dormant. In another space entirely, it was early morning in Ankh-Morpork, oldest and greatest and grubbiest of cities. Under night's damp cloak, assassins assassinated, thieves thieved, hussies hustled, and so on. And drunken Captain Vimes of the night watch staggered slowly down the street, folded gently into the gutter outside the watch house, and lay there. There was light, of course, in the library. The library was the greatest assemblage of magical texts anywhere in the multiverse. Thousands of volumes of occult lore waited its shelves. The library did not obey the normal rules of space and time. It was said that you could wander for days among the distant shelves, that there were lost tribes of research students somewhere in there. The sound of snoring was coming from underneath a battered desk, where a piece of tattered blanket barely covered what looked like a heap of sandbags, but was in fact an adult male orangutan. It was the librarian. Not many people these days remarked upon the fact that he was an ape. The change had been brought about by a magical accident, always a possibility where so many powerful books are kept together. He'd been allowed to keep his job, although allowed is not really the right word. It was the way he could roll his upper lip back to reveal more incredibly yellow teeth than any other mouth the University Council had ever seen before, that somehow made sure the matter was never really raised. But now there was another sound, the alien sound of a door creaking open. Footsteps padded across the floor and disappeared amongst the clustering shelves. But the librarian slept on, lulled by the whispering of the rain. Now a black-robed figure scurried through the midnight streets and reached a grim and forbidding portal. The figure wrapped a complex code on the dark woodwork. A tiny barred hatch opened, and one suspicious eye peered out.
"The significant owl hoots in the night," said the visitor, trying to wring the rainwater out of its robe. "Yet many grey lords go sadly to the masterless men," intoned a voice on the other side of the grill. "Hooray, hooray, for the spinster's sister's daughter," countered the dripping figure. "The good mother makes bean soup for the errant boy," said the voice behind the door. There was a pause. Then the visitor said,
"What?"
"The good mother makes bean soup for the errant boy."
There was another longer pause. Then the damp figure said,
"Are you sure the ill-built tower doesn't tremble mightily at a butterfly's passage?"
"Nope. Bean soup it is, I'm sorry."
"What about the caged whale?"
said the soaking visitor.
"Oh, the caged whale! You want the elucidated brethren of the Ebon Knight, three doors down."
The robed figure splashed further down the street. There was indeed another portal there. He knocked. The little barred hatch shot back.
"Yes?"
"Look, the significant owl hoots in the night, all right?"
"Yet many grey lords go sadly to the masterless men."
The visitor sighed.
"The caged whale knows nothing of the mighty deeps," he said, "if it makes you any happier."
There was another damp pause.
"These deeps, did you say mighty or nightly?"
"Mighty, I said mighty deeps. It's me, Brother Fingers. Look, do you want the bloody book or not?"
"Well, all right."
There was the sound of bolts sliding back. The others were waiting for Brother Fingers in the inner sanctum. standing around with the sheepish air of people not normally accustomed to wearing sinister hooded black robes. The Supreme Grand Master nodded at him.
"Do you have that which you were sent to get?"
Brother Fingers pulled a package from under his robe.
"I call the Unique and Supreme Lodge of the Elucidated Brethren to order,"
the Supreme Grand Master intoned.
"Are all here who art here? And it be well for any no less man that he should not be here, for he would be taken from this place, and his figgin placed upon a spike."
What a shower, he told himself. A bunch of incompetents, no other secret society would touch with a 10-foot scepter of authority. The sort to dislocate their fingers with even the simplest secret handshake. But incompetence with possibilities, nevertheless. Give him the ones in which the floods of venom and vindictiveness were dammed up behind thin walls of ineptitude and low-grade paranoia.
"Brethren," he said, "tonight we have matters of profound importance to discuss. The very future of Ankh-Morpork lies in our hands."
They leant closer. The Supreme Grand Master felt the beginnings of the old thrill of power.
"Do we not well know that the city is in thrall to corrupt men who wax fat on their ill-gotten gains, while better men are held back and forced into virtual servitude?"
"We certainly do,"
said Brother Doorkeeper vehemently.
"Yet it was not always thus,"
the Supreme Grand Master continued.
"There was once a golden age, when those worthy of command and respect were justly rewarded. Yes, Brother Watchtower?"
A bulky robed figure lowered its hand. "Are you talking about when we had kings?"
"Well done, brother,"
said the Supreme Grand Master, slightly annoyed at this unusual evidence of intelligence.
"And..."
"But that was all sorted out hundreds of years ago," said Brother Watchtower. "Wasn't there this great battle or something? And since then we've just had the ruling lords like the patrician."
"Yes, very good, Brother Watchtower." "However,"
said the Supreme Grand Master sharply,
"it may well be that the line of the kings of Ankh is not as defunct as hitherto imagined."
He stood back, expectantly. Brother Watchtower had his hand up again.
"Yes.
You saying there's some sort of heir to the throne hanging around somewhere?" said Brother Watchtower.
"This may be the case, yes."
"Yeah, they do that, you know," said Brother Watchtower knowledgeably. "You read about it. Skeons, they're called. They go lurking around in the distant wilderness for ages, handing down the secret sword and birthmark and so forth from generation to generation. Then, just when the old kingdom needs them, they turn up and turf out any usurpers that happen to be around." The Supreme Grand Master felt his mouth drop open.
"The thing is, the Skeon has to arrive when the kingdom is threatened," went on Brother Watchtower.
"He has to marry a princess too," said Brother Doorkeeper, "on account of him being a swineherd."
They looked at him.
"Who said anything about him being a swineherd?" said Brother Watchtower. "What's this about swineherds?"
"He's got a point, though," said Brother Plasterer. "They've got to appear to be of... you know, humble origins."
"Nothing special about humble origins,"
said a very small brother who seemed to consist entirely of a little perambulatory black robe with halitosis.
"In my family, we thought swineherding was a posh job."
"But your family doesn't have the blood of kings, Brother Dunnikin," said Brother Plasterer.
"We might have,"
said Brother Dunnikin sulkily.
"Right then," said Brother Watchtower grudgingly. "Fair enough, but at the essential moment, see, your genuine kings throw back their cloak and say low, and their essential kinglessness shines through."
"How exactly?" said Brother Doorkeeper.
"Look, it just does, okay? But before that, they've got to save the kingdom," said Brother Plasterer.
"What from, then?" said Brother Doorkeeper. "The patrician?"
Brother Watchtower shook his head.
"The patrician's not your actual oppressor as such."
"I get oppressed all the time,"
said Brother Doorkeeper. "The woman in the vegetable shop, she oppresses me all the time."
"That's right," said Brother Plasterer. "My landlord oppresses me something wicked."
"Yes, yes, yes," said the Supreme Grand Master. "Truly, the right-thinking folk of Ankh-Morpork are beneath the heel of the oppressors."
"Of course, in the old days it was easy," said Brother Doorkeeper happily.
"Why?"
"The king just had to kill a dragon."
The Supreme Grand Master clapped his hands together.
"What an interesting idea," he trilled.
"Wouldn't work," said Brother Watchtower dourly. "There ain't no big dragons now."
"There could be."
"Come again," said Brother Watchtower.
"I said, there could be."
"What? The real thing? Great big scales and wings?"
"Yes. If you want dragons, you can have dragons, Brother Watchtower. You can bring a dragon here. Now, into the city."
"Me?"
"All of you. I mean, us," said the Supreme Grand Master. "And it would obey your every command."
That stopped them. That pulled them up.
"What? A real dragon?"
The Supreme Grand Master's eyes rolled.
"Yes, a real one. Not a little pet swamp dragon. The genuine article."
"But I thought they were, you know, myths,"
said Brother Plasterer. The Supreme Grand Master leant forward.
"They were myths. And they were real," he said loudly. "I will demonstrate. The book, please, Brother Fingers. Thank you, brethren. The belief that dragons died out is quite wrong, and they can be summoned. This book," he flourished it, "gives specific instructions."
"It's just in the book," said Brother Plasterer.
"No ordinary book. It's in the handwriting of Tubal de Malakiti, a great student of dragon lore. He summons dragons of all sizes, and so can you."
There was another long, awkward silence.
"Sounds a bit like, you know, magic to me," said Brother Watchtower.
"Yeah," said Brother Plasterer uncomfortably.
"It's, the wizards, see,"
said Brother Fingers. "The wizards round here come down on you like a ton of bricks if they catches you doing anything like that."
"Demarcation, they call it," said Brother Plasterer. "Like, I don't go around fiddling with the mystic interleaved what's-names of causality, and they don't do any plastering."
The brethren shuffled uneasily. Then Brother Dunnikin spoke.
"Huh. Wizards, what do they know about a day's work?"
The Supreme Grand Master breathed deeply. The air of mean-minded resentfulness thickened noticeably.
"Then we are all agreed, brethren. You are prepared to practice magic?"
"Oh, practice," said Brother Plasterer, relieved. "I don't mind practicing."
The Supreme Grand Master thumped the book.
"I mean carry out real spells. Summon a dragon," he shouted.
They took a step back. Then Brother Doorkeeper said,
"And then, if we get this dragon, the rightful king will turn up just like that."
"Yes,"
said the Supreme Grand Master. There was a moment's hesitation, and then a general nodding of cowls. Only Brother Doorkeeper looked vaguely unhappy.
"Could we get it to stay here just long enough to burn down, for example, any oppressive vegetable shops?"
"Ah, he'd won. There'd be dragons again, and a king again. A king who would do what he was told."
"That," said the Supreme Grand Master, "depends on how much help you can be. We shall need, initially, any items of magic you can bring."
Now pull back briefly from the dripping streets of Ankh-Morpork, pan across the morning mists of the disk, and focus in again on a young man heading for the city with all the openness, sincerity and innocence of purpose of an iceberg drifting into a major shipping lane. The young man is called Carrot, This is not because of his hair, it's because of his shape. When he flexes his shoulder muscles, other muscles have to move out of the way first. He is also bearing a sword presented to him in mysterious circumstances. It isn't magical, it hasn't got a name, it's just a long piece of metal with very sharp edges. And it hasn't got destiny written all over it. It's practically unique, in fact. Carrot had always known he was different. One day, his father had come up to him, or rather, come up to his waist, and told him that he was not, in fact, as he had always believed, a dwarf.
"We didn't like to say so before, son," said his father. "We thought you'd grow out of it, see?"
"Grow out of what?" said Carrot.
"Growing. But now your mother thinks, that is, we both think, it's time you went out among your own kind."
"What is my own kind, then?" said Carrot, bewildered.
The old dwarf took a deep breath.
"You're human,"
he said.
"What, like Mr. Varneshi?"
"You're 6'6", lad. He's only 5 foot."
"Hold on," said Carrot. "You're a dwarf, right? And Mam's a dwarf. So I should be a dwarf too. Fact of life."
The dwarf sighed.
"Sit down, lad,"
he said. Carrot sat.
"The thing is,"
he said wretchedly,
"we found you in the woods one day, toddling about near one of the tracks. Thing is, you see, there were these carts on fire, as you might say, and dead people. Yes, because of bandits. So we took you in, of course, and then, well, your mum got used to you. That's the long and the short of it."
Carrot took this fairly calmly. As far as he was aware, being found toddling in the woods was the normal method of childbirth.
"All right, Dad," he said. "But, you know, me and, you know, Minty Rocksmacker, she's really beautiful. We've got an understanding and..."
"Yes,"
said the dwarf coldly.
"Oh, no. Her father's had a word with me. It's not that they don't like you. You're a steady lad and a fine worker. You'd make a good son-in-law." "Four good sons-in-law. That's the trouble."
He discussed it with Varneshi, a good solid man, Varneshi.
"You could chop his legs off,"
the old man had suggested.
"It's not his legs that's going to be the problem,"
said the dwarf darkly.
"Ah, yes. Well, in that case, you could..."
"No!"
"No,"
agreed Varneshi thoughtfully.
"You could send him to work with humans in the big city, get him a job in...
Varneshi sought for inspiration.
"In the watch or something. My great-grandfather was in the watch, you know. Fine job for a big lad, my grandad said."
"What is a watch?"
said the dwarf.
"Oh," said Varneshi quietly. "They goes about making sure people keep the laws and do what they're told."
"This is a very proper concern,"
said the dwarf. Carrot took the news without fuss. He would go to this city and have a man made of him. After some thought, the dwarf wrote to the ruler of Ankh-Morpork, respectfully asking if Carrot could be considered for a place among the city's finest. Months had gone by, and then there'd been the reply. It said baldly that his application was accepted, and would he present himself for duty immediately.
"Just like that,"
Carrot said. The dwarf had pulled a sack from under his chair, rummaged around in it, and presented Carrot with a length of metal, more a sword than a saw, but only just.
"This might rightly belong to you," he said. "When we found the carts, this was the only thing left. The bandits, you see. Just between you and me,"
he beckoned Carrot closer,
"we had a witch look at it in case it was magic. But it isn't."
He handed it over. He rummaged around some more.
"And in this,"
he held up a shirt,
"it'll protect you."
Carrot fingered it carefully.
It was made from the wool of ram-top sheep, which had all the warmth and softness of hog bristles. It was one of the legendary woolly dwarf vests, the kind of vest that needs hinges.
And, that reminds me, said the dwarf. Mr. Varnesi says he'd like you to drop in on the way down the mountain. He's got something for you.
Carrot had taken the sword, slung on his back, sandwiches and clean underwear in his pack, and the world, more or less, at his feet. In his pocket was the famous letter from the patrician, the man who ruled the great fine city of Ankh-Morpork. At least, that's how his mother had referred to it. The signature was something like Lupin Squiggle Seki PP. Vaneshi was sitting outside his hut.
Hello, Carrot,
he said, leading the way inside.
Looking forward to the city?
Carrot gave this due consideration. No, he said.
Your dad give you the sword, did he?
Said Varneshi, rummaging on a fetid shelf.
Yes, and a woolly vest to protect me against chills.
Varneshi turned around and added dramatically,
This belonged to my great-grandfather.
It was a strange, vaguely hemispherical device surrounded by straps.
It's some sort of sling, said Carrot.
Varneshi told him what it was.
Codpiece like in fish, said Carrot, mystified.
No, it's for the fighting, mumbled Varneshi. You should wear it all the time, protects your vitals like.
Carrot tried it on.
It's a bit small, Mr. Varneshi.
That's because you don't wear it on your head, you see.
Varneshi explained some more.
My great-granddad used to say, he finished, that but for this, I wouldn't be here today.
What did he mean by that?
I've no idea, Varneshi said spinelessly.
There'd been another gift from Mr. Varneshi. It was a small but very thick book. It was called The Laws and Ordinances of the Cities of Ankh and Morpork.
You have to know all the laws, he said virtuously, to be a good officer.
It was a 500-mile journey and surprisingly quite uneventful. Carrot had spent most of the journey reading. And now Ankh-Morpork was before him. There was a guard on the gate. Carrot saluted him and presented the letter. The man looked at it for some time.
He said eventually. I think I've got to see Lupin Squiggle Seki PP, said Carrot.
Well, I don't know about any Seki, said the guard. You want Captain Vimes of the Night Watch.
And where is he based? Said Carrot politely.
At this time of day I'd try the bunch of grapes in Easy Street, said the guard.
He looked Carrot up and down.
Join in the watch, are you?
I hope to prove worthy, yes, said Carrot.
The guard gave him what could loosely be called an old-fashioned look. It was practically Neolithic.
What was it you'd done? He said.
My father wrote a letter, said Carrot proudly. I've been volunteered.
Bloody hellfire, said the guard.
Now it was night again, and beyond the dread portal...
Now, brethren, you have all brought the items as instructed, said the Supreme Grand Master.
There was a general murmuring.
Place them in the circle of conjuration.
It was a sorry collection. Bring magical things, he'd said. Only Brother Fingers had produced anything worthwhile. It looked like some sort of altar ornament, best not to ask from where. The Supreme Grand Master turned and picked up the book.
And now, he said wearily, if we are all quite ready...
Ready for what, Supreme Grand Master?
Brother Watchtower said.
For the summoning, of course. Think hard about dragons, all of you.
That's all, is it?
Said Brother Doorkeeper.
Yes.
Don't we have to chant a mystic prune or something?
Brother Doorkeeper hadn't joined a secret society not to chant mystic runes.
You can, if you like, said the Supreme Grand Master.
He opened the book.
He'd been rather surprised to find, after pages and pages of pious ramblings, that the actual summoning itself was one short sentence. Around him, the brethren were chanting what each man considered to be something mystical. He looked down and spoke the words aloud. Nothing happened. He blinked. When he opened his eyes again, he was in a dark alley, his stomach was full of fire, and he was very angry. It was about to be the worst night of his life for Zebo Mooty, thief third class. It was also going to be the last one. In the night-time streets of Ankh-Morpork, caution is an absolute. You are either very cautious or you are dead. He heard the muffled sounds coming from the nearby alley, waited until the victim was almost turning the corner, sprang out, said, "Oh, shit!" and died. It was a most unusual death. The stone wall behind him glowed cherry red with heat, which gradually faded into darkness. He was the first to see the Ankh-Morpork dragon. He derived little comfort from knowing this, however, because he was dead. The Supreme Grand Master opened his eyes. He was lying on his back. Brother Dunnikin was preparing to give him the kiss of life. The mere thought was enough to jerk anyone from the borders of consciousness.
"We did it," he whispered. "The dragon. It came. I felt it."
"We never saw nothing," said Brother Plasterer.
"No, not here,"
snapped the Supreme Grand Master.
"It was out there, in the city, just for a few seconds."
He pointed.
"Look."
In the centre of the circle, the magic items were gently crumbling to dust.
"Sucked dry,"
whispered Brother Fingers.
"I'll be damned." "But it proves it works," said the Supreme Grand Master. "Don't you see, you fools? It works. We can summon dragons."
"Hang on, though," said Brother Plasterer. "Where's this dragon gone?"
"It stayed only as long as the magic lasted," said the Supreme Grand Master. "Then it went back. If we want it to stay longer, we need more magic. Understand?"
"Dearest Father," wrote Carrot, "well, here I am in Ankh-Morpork. It's not like at home. I don't think people here know right from wrong. I found Captain Vimes in a common alehouse. He told me to find a place to stay and report to Sergeant Colon at the watch house tonight. I went for a walk. I found a place. It is called The Shades. Then I saw some men trying to rob a young lady. I set about them. One of them tried to kick me in the vitals, but I was wearing the protective as instructed, and he hurt himself. Then the lady came up to me and said, 'Was I interested in bed?' I said, 'Yes.' She took me to where she lived, a boarding house, I think it is called. It is run by a Mrs. Palm. The lady whose purse it was is called Reet. So I went upstairs and fell asleep. Reet woke me up once or twice to say, 'Do you want anything?' But they had no apples. I have been given some chain mail. I hope you are all well. This afternoon I will go and look at the Thieves' Guild. It is disgraceful. Your loving son, Carrot."
Lord Vetinari, the patrician of Ankh-Morpork, put his hand over his eyes.
"He did what?"
"I was marched through the streets," said Erdo Van Pugh, currently president of the Guild of Thieves, "in broad daylight, like a common criminal."
He took a few steps towards the patrician's severe chair of office, waving a finger. The finger was a mistake. The patrician was staring coldly at the finger. The patrician was not a man you shook a finger at, unless you wanted to end up being able to count only to 9.
"And you say this was one person?" said Lord Vetinari. "Yes, that is,"
Van Pugh hesitated.
"But there are hundreds of you in there," said the patrician calmly.
Van Pugh opened and shut his mouth a few times.
"Thank you. Do not let me detain you," said the patrician.
When he'd gone, Lord Vetinari rang the little bronze bell that summoned his secretary. The man's name, despite his handwriting, was Lupine Wants. "The watch appears to be having some difficulty with the Thieves' Guild," said the patrician. "Van Pugh has been in here claiming that a member of the watch arrested him."
"What for, sir?"
"Being a thief, apparently."
"A member of the watch?" said the secretary.
"I know. But just sort it out, will you?" One of the patrician's greatest contributions to the reliable operation of Ankh-Morpork had been, very early in his administration, the legalising of the ancient guild of thieves. Crime was always with us, he reasoned, and therefore, if you were going to have crime, it at least should be organised crime. And so the guild had been encouraged to come out of the shadows and build a big guild house, take their place at civic banquets and so on. In exchange for the winding down of the watch, they agreed to keep crime levels to a level to be determined annually. That way, everyone could plan ahead, said Lord Vetinari. And so the city prospered, while the watch had dwindled away into a handful of unemployables who no one in their right mind could ever take seriously. Captain Vimes always felt uneasy in the presence of Lupine Wants. He'd known Wants since their childhood in the Shades. He was never a gang leader. But in every gang, there is a pale youth who's allowed to stay because he's the one who comes up with all the clever ideas, usually to do with old women and unlocked shops. Vimes remembered Wants as a skinny little kid, always tagging along behind, with the kind of odd skipping run he'd invented to keep up with the bigger boys.
"Ah, Vimes."
"Sir," said Vimes woodenly. Wants rummaged in the papers of his desk.
"Strange things afoot, Vimes. Serious complaint about you, I'm afraid," he said.
"Sir?"
"One of your night watchmen. Seems he arrested at the head of the Thieves' Guild."
Vimes swayed a little and tried hard to focus.
"One of my men?" "Yes."
Wants grinned mirthlessly.
"Tied him up and left him in front of the palace. There was a note. Here it is. This man is charged with conspiracy to commit crime under Section 14 III of the General Felonies Act 1678 by me, Carrot Iron Founderson."
Vimes squinted at him. 14 III?
"Apparently," said Wants.
The captain shook his head and winced.
"Carrot? Doesn't ring a bell?"
Wants hesitated.
"Carrot. Carrot," he said. "I've heard the name before, seen it written down."
His face went blank.
"The Volunteer, that was it. Remember me showing you?"
Vimes stared at him. "Wasn't there a letter from, I don't know, some dwarf?"
"That's right, begging that his son would be found suitable for a humble position in the watch."
"What had he done?" said Vimes.
"Nothing. That was it, not a blessed thing."
"A volunteer?" Vimes said.
"Yes."
Wants folded his hands on the desk and leant forward.
"Now look, Captain," he said. "Lordship wants an explanation. So I'll think of something to tell him, and you, Captain, will give this dwarf a short lesson in what it means to be a guard, all right?"
said Vimes dutifully.
"I'm sorry," said Wants.
Vimes saluted.
"Right you are, Mr. Secretary," he said. "I'll see to it that he learns that arresting thieves is against the law."
"Dearest Mother," Carrot wrote, "it has been a much better day. I went into the Thieves' Guild and arrested the chief miscreant and dragged him to the patrician's palace. No more trouble from him, I fancy. And Mrs. Palm says I can stay in the attic because it is always useful to have a man around the place. I do not understand some of the watch duties. I have a partner. His name is Nobby. He says I have got a lot to learn. I think this is true because I have only got up to page 326 in the laws and ordinances of the cities of Ankh and Morpork. Love to all, your son Carrot. P.S. Love to Minty.
It wasn't just the loneliness. It was the back-to-front way of living, that was it, thought Vimes. You spent your life in the dark. Sergeant Colon, he thought, as he stumbled into the musty gloom of the watch-house. Now there was a man who liked the dark. Sergeant Colon owed 30 years of happy marriage to the fact that Mrs. Colon worked all day and Sergeant Colon worked all night. They communicated by means of notes. And Corporal Nobbs. Well, the only reason you couldn't say that Nobby was close to the animal kingdom was that the animal kingdom would get up and walk away. And then, of course, there was himself. Just a skinny, unshaven collection of bad habits marinated in alcohol. And that was the night watch, just the three of them. Once there'd been dozens, hundreds, and now just three. Vimes fumbled his way up the stairs and groped his way into his office, scrabbled in a drawer, and grabbed a bottle. The world swam into focus. After a few minutes, a distant wheezing indicated that Sergeant Colon was climbing the stairs. He entered and saluted.
"Evening, Captain," he said.
"What's this about a dwarf, Sergeant?" said Vimes abruptly. Colon's brow wrinkled.
"What dwarf?"
"The one who's just joined the watch, name of..." Vimes hesitated. "Carrot or something?"
"M?" Colon's mouth dropped open. "He's a dwarf? The little sod must have lied about his height."
"Do you know he arrested the president of the Thieves' Guild this morning?"
"No. We've got to get him off the streets as soon as possible," Vimes muttered.
"Where is he?"
"I sent him out with Corporal Nobbs, Captain. I said he'd show him the rope sort of thing."
"Let's just hope he's a slow learner," said Vimes. "Come on." Men like Corporal Nobbs can be found in every armed force. He smoked incessantly and had a dog end permanently lodged behind his ear, which was a sort of nicotine elephant's graveyard. He was a small, bandy-legged man, with a certain resemblance to a chimpanzee who never got invited to tea parties.
"Cushy number, this route,"
he said, as they strolled along a damp street in the merchant's quarter. He tried a door handle. It was locked.
"Used it with me,"
he added,
"and I'll see you're all right." "Back in the mountains," said Carrot, "if a thief was caught, he was hung up by the..."
He paused, idly rattling a doorknob. Nobby froze.
"By the what?"
he said, in horrified fascination.
"By the town hall," said Carrot, "sometimes for days." "Why did you have to become a guard, lad?"
Nobby said.
"I didn't have to," said Carrot. "I wanted to. It will make a man of me."
Nobby never looked anyone directly in the eye. He stared at Carrot's right ear in amazement.
"You mean you ain't running away from anything?"
he said.
"What would I want to run away from anything for?"
Nobby floundered a bit.
There's always something. Maybe you was wrongly accused of something. You can tell old Nobby, or..."
He nudged Carrot.
"Sure, laughing, eh? Got a girl into trouble?"
"I..." Carrot began. The truth was that he was always getting Minty into trouble. He could hear her father and mother shouting at her.
"Yes, all the time," said Carrot. "Just about every night, really." "Blimey,"
said Nobby, impressed. He looked down at the protective.
"Is that why they make you wear that, then?"
"What do you mean?"
"Well, don't worry about it," said Nobby. "So, where are you staying, lad?"
"There's a lady called Mrs. Palm,"
Carrot began. Nobby choked.
"In the shades?"
he wheezed.
"You're staying there?"
"Oh, yes."
"And you've come here to have a man made of you?"
"Look," said Carrot, thoroughly lost. "I came because Mr. Varneshi said it was the finest job in the world, upholding the law and everything. That's right, isn't it? Look, I've got this book Mr. Varneshi gave me."
He fumbled for the laws and ordinances. He was nearly terminally interrupted by an axe that whirred out of a low doorway beside him and bounced off the opposite wall.
"Hey, Nobby!" said Carrot urgently. "There's a fight going on!"
Nobby glanced at the doorway.
"Of course there is," he said. "It's a dwarf bar. Worst kind."
He grabbed Carrot's tree-trunk arm. Carrot had gone pale.
"Dwarfs drinking and fighting?"
he said.
"You bet,"
said Nobby.
"All the time. Don't go in there."
But Carrot had waded into the scuffling mass. He cupped his hands around his mouth and bellowed something in a language Nobby didn't understand. The fighting stopped. 100 bearded faces glared up at Carrot's stooped figure, their annoyance mingled with surprise. A battered tankard bounced off his breastplate. No dwarf had ever heard so many old tongue words from the mouth of anyone over 4 feet high. They were astonished. There were tears in Carrot's eyes.
"You dwarfs," he said. "Dwarfs shouldn't be acting like this. Aren't you ashamed?"
100 bone-hard jaws dropped.
"I mean, look at you."
Carrot shook his head.
"Can you imagine what your poor white-bearded old mother would think if she saw you now?"
Nobby, standing by the doorway in terror and amazement, was aware of a growing chorus of nose-blowings and muffled sobs.
"Now then," said Carrot kindly, "I shall be coming past here every night from now on, and I shall expect to see proper standards of dwarf behaviour. I know what it's like when you're far from home, but there's no excuse for this sort of thing. Gook! Cheek!"
As he emerged into the street, Nobby tapped him on the arm.
"Don't you ever do anything like that to me again," he fumed. "You're in the city watch. Don't give me any more of this law business."
"But it is very important," said Carrot seriously.
"Dwarf bars," said Nobby. "If you got any sense, my lad, you'll come in here and shut up."
Carrot stared up at the building they'd reached. A battered sign hung over the door. It showed a drum.
"A tavern, is it?"
said Carrot thoughtfully.
"Open at this hour?"
"Don't see why not," said Nobby. "Damn useful idea. The mended drum."
"And more drinking?"
Carrot thumbed hastily through the book.
"I hope so,"
said Nobby. He nodded to the troll, which was employed by the drum as a splatter.
"Evening, detritus. Just showing the new lad the ropes."
The inside of the mended drum is now legendary as the most famous disreputable tavern on the Discworld. The conversation dipped fractionally as the two guards wandered in. Nobby realised that Carrot was busy.
"What are you doing?"
he said.
"I'm taking notes," said Carrot grimly. "I've got a notebook."
"That's the ticket,"
said Nobby.
"You'll like this place. What do you want to drink?"
"Strong drink is a mocker," said Carrot.
He was aware of a penetrating stare in the back of his neck and turned and looked into the big, bland and gentle face of an orangutan. It was seated at the bar with a pint mug and a bowl of peanuts in front of it. It tilted its glass amicably towards Carrot and then drank deeply and noisily, by apparently forming its lower lip into a sort of prehensile funnel and making a noise like a canal being drained. Carrot nudged Nobby.
"There's a monk," he began.
"Don't say it," said Nobby urgently. "It's a librarian. Works up at the university. Always comes down here for a nightcap of an evening."
"Who is the owner, proprietor, lessee or landlord of these premises?"
Carrot said to Nobby.
"What's that?"
said the small guard.
"Landlord? Well, I suppose Charlie is in charge tonight. Charlie, this is Carrot,"
said Nobby.
"If you are in charge," Carrot intoned, "then it is my duty to inform you that you are under arrest."
"Arrest of what, friend?" said Charlie, still polishing.
"Under
"Arrest," said Carrot, "with a view to the presentation of charges to wit one, little one, that on or about the 18th of Groon, at a place called the Mended Drum Filigree Street, you did A, serve, or B, did cause to serve, alcoholic beverages after the hours of 12 midnight, contrary to the provisions of the Public Ale Houses Opening Act of 1678, and two, little one, that on or about the 18th of Groon, at a place called the Mended Drum Filigree Street, you did allow customers to carry unsheathed edge weapons of a length greater than 7 inches, contrary to Section 3 of said Act." There was dead silence. "It is also my duty to inform you that it is my intention to lay evidence before the justices with a view to the consideration of charges under the," he glanced sideways at the librarian, "the Domestic and Domesticated Animals Care and Protection Act, 1673. Charlie carefully put down the glasses. "What do you mean, justices?" he said to Nobby. Nobby gave a terrified shrug. "Detritus, get your big stony arse over here a moment," said Charlie. Generally about this time in the Mended Drum, someone throws a glass, and in fact, this now happened. Captain Vimes ran up Short Street with Sergeant Colon stumbling along behind, protesting. Nobby was outside the drum, hopping from one foot to another.
He's fighting in there," he stuttered.
"All by himself?" said the captain.
"No, with everyone," shouted Nobby.
"Huh." There was a crash as a nearby window burst outwards. "I think," said the captain carefully, "that we'd better take prompt action."
"That's right," said Sergeant Colon. "A man could get hurt standing here."
They sidled cautiously a little way down the street. There was the occasional scream from within the tavern, and every now and again a mysterious ringing noise as though someone was hitting a gong with their knee.
"You had your holidays this year, Sergeant?"
said Captain Vimes eventually, rocking back and forth on his heels.
"Yes, sir. Sent the wife to Quirm last month, sir, to see her aunt."
"Very nice." A tremendous crash tore the door of the Mended Drum out of the wall. A figure in the midst of the wreckage tried to raise itself on its elbows, groaned and slumped back. Nobby said,
"It's that bloody troll."
"What?" said Vimes.
"It's the troll, the one they have on the door."
They advanced with extreme caution. It was indeed Detritus the Splatter.
"There is a turn-up for the books," said the sergeant vaguely.
"You don't think that he's winning, do you?" The captain thrust out his jaw.
"We owe it to our colleague and fellow officer," he said, "to find out."
They peered cautiously around the ravished doorway. Carrot stood in the middle of the floor. His rusty chainmail was torn, his helmet was missing, and he was swaying a little from side to side. He threw a salute.
"Beg to report 31 offences of making an affray, sir, and 56 cases of riotous behaviour, 13 offences of assault with a deadly weapon, and Corporal Nobby hasn't even shown me one rope yet."
He fell backwards, breaking a table. The Supreme Grand Master raised his hands.
"Are the thuribles of destiny ritually chastised, that evil and loose thinking may be banished from the sanctified circle?"
"Yep."
The Supreme Grand Master lowered his hands.
"Yep,"
he said.
"Yep,"
said Brother Dunnikin happily.
"Done it myself."
"You are supposed to say, 'Yea, O Supreme One,'" said the Supreme Grand Master. "Very well, then. Tonight we'll try another experimental summoning. I trust you have obtained suitable raw material, brothers?"
"All sorted out, Supreme Grand Master," said Brother Watchtower.
It was, the Grand Master conceded, a slightly better collection.
"Right," he said, taking up the book. "We will begin to commence."
It had been a trying night, and the watch had been steadying their nerves. Captain Vimes passed the bottle back to the sergeant.
"Shame on
He thought for a bit.
You, he said, drunk in front of a super officer. Put yourself on the charge.
Vague visions were trotting through his mind of a room full of criminal types, people that had jeered at him, people whose very existence had offended and taunted him for years, lying around and groaning. Some almost forgotten part of him, some much younger Vimes with a bright shining breastplate and big hopes, a Vimes he thought the alcohol had long ago drowned, was suddenly restless. The four of them bounced gently off a wall.
We show them tonight, Vimes said excitedly. Show them, do we? Saw them and forget they weren't listening in a hurry, eh?
That's right,
said the sergeant.
Ah!
Vimes shouted at the dark alleyways.
Don't like it, eh? Well, now you can bootle in your trims. 2 o'clock, he yelled. And all's well.
Carrot raised his muzzy head.
Where are we?
He groaned.
On our way home, said the sergeant. We're just going down, he squinted. Sweetheart Lane.
Sweetheart Lane's not on the way home,
slurred Nobby.
It's in the shades. Cash house going down Sweetheart Lane.
There was a crowded moment in which realisation did the icy work of several pints of black coffee.
What are we going to do, Captain?
Said Colon. They could hear footsteps.
Hey, what was that?
What?
There it was again, sort of a slithery sound.
Captain Vimes tried not to think about hoods and garrotting. And then there was a sound. Perhaps a volcanic sound, or the sound of a boiling geyser, but at any rate a long, dry roar of a sound. But it was not so bad as the light, which was blue-white. They both went on forever and then instantly stopped. The guards could see an indistinct red glow ahead of them. It turned out to be a wall, cooling rapidly. But the worst bit was what was on the wall. They stared at it for a long time. Eventually, Colon stretched uneasily and said,
"Chin up, Captain. It could have been worse."
Vimes finished the bottle.
"Yeah," he said. "It could have been us."
You need a special kind of mind to rule a city like Ankh-Morpork, and Lord Veterinary had it, but then he was a special kind of person. He stared at the stricken wall for a long time. Behind him, Wants hovered nervously. The shapes outlined in brickwork showed a tableau of 6 men frozen in an attitude of surprise. Various upraised hands had quite clearly been holding knives and cutlasses. He said. Captain Vimes respectfully led the patrician across the lane and into Fast Luck Alley, where he pointed out Exhibit A, to wit, footprints, he said. Which is stretching it a bit, sir. They're more what you call claws. One might go so far as to say talons. The patrician stared at the prints in the mud.
I see, he said eventually. And do you have an opinion about all this, Captain?
Well, sir, he said, I know that dragons have been extinct for thousands of years, sir.
Yes?
The patrician's eyes narrowed. Vimes plunged on.
Well, Sergeant Colon said he heard a slithery sound just before the offence.
So you think an extinct and indeed a possibly entirely mythical dragon flew into the city, landed in this narrow alley, incinerated a group of criminals, and then flew away? Said the patrician.
Well, when you put it like that.
If I recall, the dragons of legend were solitary and rural creatures who shunned people and dwelt in forsaken out-of-the-way places, said the patrician. The captain repressed a comment that if you wanted to find a really forsaken out-of-the-way place, then the shades would fit the bill pretty well. In my opinion,
said Lord Veterinary. "It's some kind of warfare. Possibly a rival gang has hired a wizard." "But there's the footprint, sir," said Vimes doggedly. "We're close to the river," said the patrician. "Possibly it was, perhaps, a wading bird of some sort." "A mere coincidence," he added. "But I should cover them over if I were you." Vimes gave in. "As you wish, sir," he said, looking at his sandals. The patrician turned and almost walked into the wall of chain mail that was Carrot. To his horror, Captain Vimes saw his newest recruit point politely to the patrician's coach. He heard Carrot say, "Excuse me, sir, is this your coach, sir?" And the patrician looked him blankly up and down and said, "It is. Who are you, young man?" Carrot saluted. "Lance Constable Carrot, sir." "Carrot. Carrot, that name rings a bell." "About your coach, sir," said Carrot doggedly. "I couldn't help noticing that the front offside wheel, contrary to the..." "He's going to arrest the patrician," Vimes told himself, the thought trickling through his brain like an icy rivulet. "The supreme ruler. We're all dead. Or worse, we're all detained at the patrician's pleasure. And, as we all know, he's seldom that pleased." It was at this precise moment that Sergeant Colon earned himself a metaphorical medal. "Lance Constable Carrot," he shouted. "Attention, Lance Constable Carrot, about that. Lance Constable Carrot, Kiwik Marcha." Carrot brought himself to attention like a barn being raised and stared straight ahead with a ferocious expression of acute obedience. "Well done, that man," said the patrician thoughtfully as Carrot strode stiffly away. "Carry on, Captain. And do come down heavily on any silly rumours about dragons, right?"
"Yes, sir,"
said Captain Vimes. Vimes looked at the prints in the mud. He used his regulation pike, which he knew was exactly 7 feet long, to measure their size and the distance between them. He whistled under his breath. Then, with considerable caution, he followed the alley round the corner. It led to a small, padlocked and dirt-encrusted door in the back of a timber warehouse. "There was something very wrong," he thought. "The prints come out of the alley, but they don't go in." "So," he thought, "something big and fiery came out of this alley but didn't come into it." He noticed something else, and bent down and picked up a fresh, empty peanut shell. The librarian knuckled his way urgently along the dark aisles between the slumbering bookshelves. It had seemed amusing and instructive to follow the watch into the shades, an urban jungle which held no fears for a 300-pound ape. But now the nightmare he had seen while brachiating across a dark alley would, if he had been human, have made him doubt the evidence of his own eyes. Right now he wanted to concentrate his eyes urgently on a book that might hold a clue. It was in a section no one bothered with much these days. Dust lay accusingly on the floor. Dust with footprints in it. Said the librarian in the warm gloom. He proceeded cautiously now. He turned a corner, and there it was. The section. The bookcase. The shelf. The gap. Someone had stolen a book. What was making Captain Vimes angry with himself was that he had disobeyed orders. He had scuffed up the track, certainly. But in the bottom drawer of his ancient desk, hidden under a pile of empty bottles, was a plaster cast. He couldn't imagine what had got into him, and now he was going even further out onto the limb. He reviewed his, for want of a better word, troops. He'd asked the senior pair to turn up in plain clothes. This meant that Sergeant Colon, who'd worn uniform all his life, was looking red-faced and uncomfortable in the suit he wore for funerals, whereas Nobby... Vimes walked slowly around the corporal. "Your plain clothes do not cause old women to faint and small boys to run after you in the street," he said. Nobby shifted uneasily. He wasn't at home with irony.
"No, Sir Gov," he said. "It's all a go, this style."
This was broadly true. There was a current fad in Ankh for big feathered hats, ruffs, slashed doublets with gold frogging, flared pantaloons and boots with ornamental spurs. Vimes brought his attention back to the business in hand. "I want you to," he said to Nobbs and Colon, "to mingle unab-